The following program is brought to you by Audio Journal, a radio reading service intended for a print-impaired audience. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind, with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, its staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome all to Audio Journal's Extraordinary Tales, the program that offers its print-impaired audience and other listeners the opportunity to listen to stories that are off the beaten path, inspiring awe, wonder, and at times, terror and fright that will send shivers down your spine. This production is brought to you in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. I'm George Bloomquist, and today I'll be sharing several stories with you that are truly off the beaten path, beginning with H.P. Lovecraft's chilling yarn, The Beast in the Cave, as found in the book titled The Complete Fiction of H.P. Lovecraft, Easton Press, 2017. Before I begin the story, though, here's a brief biographical sketch about the author. Howard Phillips Lovecraft was born on August 20, 1890, in Providence, Rhode Island, and he lived most of his life in New England in relative anonymity, writing short stories featuring weird and fantastical themes, as well as creating his so-called Cthulhu mythos, as featured in a number of pulp magazines during his lifetime. Lovecraft's literary work was rooted in cosmicism, which was simultaneously his personal philosophy and the main theme of his fiction. Now, cosmicism posits that humanity is an insignificant part of the cosmos and can be swept away at any moment, and Lovecraft incorporated science fiction into his stories to emphasize mankind's fragility in this dynamic. Much like Poe, Lovecraft's fame came after his passing, and a scholarly revival of his works began in the 1970s, resulting in his now being regarded as one of the most significant 20th century authors of the supernatural horror fiction genre. During the final 11 years of his life, he produced most of his popular stories, including The Call of Cthulhu, At the Mountain of Madness, The Shadow Over Innsmouth, and The Shadow Out of Time. Sadly, H.P. Lovecraft succumbed to intestinal cancer on March 15, 1937, at the relatively young age of 46. Here now is The Beast in the Cave by H.P. Lovecraft. The horrible conclusion which had been gradually obtruding itself upon my confused and reluctant mind was now an awful certainty. I was lost, completely, hopelessly lost, in the vast and labyrinthine recesses of the mammoth cave. Turn as I might, in no direction could my straining vision seize on any object capable of serving as a guidepost to set me on the outward path. That nevermore should I behold the blessed light of day, or scan the pleasant hills and dales of the beautiful world outside, my reason could no longer entertain the slightest unbelief. Hope had departed. Yet, indoctrinated as I was by a life of philosophical study, I derived no small measure of satisfaction from my unimpassioned demeanor. For although I had frequently read of the wild frenzies into which were thrown the victims of similar situations, I experienced none of these, but stood quietly as soon as I clearly realized the loss of my bearings. Nor did the thought that I had probably wandered beyond the utmost limits of an ordinary search cause me to abandon my composure even for a moment. If I must die, I reflected, then was this terrible yet majestic cavern as welcome a sepulchre as that which any churchyard might afford? A conception which carried with it more of tranquillity than of despair. Starving would prove my ultimate fate, of course. Of this I was certain. Some, I knew, had gone mad under circumstances such as these, but I felt that this end would not be mine. My disaster was the result of no fault save my own, since unbeknown to the guide I had separated myself from the regular party of sightseers, and wandering for over an hour in forbidden avenues of the cave, I had found myself unable to retrace the devious windings which I had pursued since forsaking my companions. Already my torch had begun to expire. Soon I would be enveloped by the total and almost palpable blackness of the bowels of the earth. As I stood in the waning, unsteady light, I idly wondered over the exact circumstances of my coming end. I remembered the accounts which I had heard of the colony of contemplatives, who, taking their residence in this gigantic grotto to find health from the apparently salubrious air of the underground world, with its steady, uniform temperature, pure air, and peaceful quiet, had found instead death in strange and ghastly form. I had seen the sad remains of the ill-made cottages as I passed them by with the party, and had wondered what unnatural influence a long sojourn in this immense and silent cavern would exert upon one as healthy and as vigorous as I. Now, I grimly told myself, my opportunity for settling this point had arrived, provided that want of food should not bring me too speedy a departure from this life. As the last fitful rays of my torch faded into obscurity, I resolved to leave no stone unturned, no possible means of escape neglected. So, summoning all the powers possessed by my lungs, I set up a series of loud shoutings, in the vain hope of attracting the attention of the guide by my clamor. Yet, as I called, I believed in my heart that my cries were of no purpose, and that my voice, magnified and reflected by the numberless ramparts of the black maze about me, fell upon no ears save my own. All at once, however, my attention was fixed with a start, as I fancied that I heard the sound of soft approaching steps on the rocky floor of the cavern. Was my deliverance about to be accomplished so soon? Had, then, all my horrible apprehensions been for naught, and was the guide, having marked my unwarranted absence from the party, following my course and seeking me out in the limestone labyrinth? Whilst these joyful questions arose in my brain, I was on the point of renewing my cries in order my discovery might come the sooner, when, in an instant, my delight was turned to horror as I listened. For my ever-acute ear, now sharpened in the even greater degree by the complete silence of the cave, bore to my benumbed understanding the unexpected and dreadful knowledge that these footfalls were not like those of a mortal man. In the unearthly stillness of this subterranean region, the tread of the booted guide would have sounded like a series of sharp and incisive blows. These impacts were soft and stealthy, as of the padded paws of some feline. Besides, at times, when I listened carefully, I seemed to trace the falls of 4 instead of 2 feet. I was now convinced that I had, by my cries, aroused and attracted some wild beast, perhaps a mountain lion which had accidentally strayed within the cave. Perhaps, I considered, the Almighty had chosen for me a swifter and more merciful death than that of hunger. Yet the instinct of self-preservation, never wholly dormant, was stirred in my breast, and though escape from the oncoming peril might but spare me from a sterner and more lingering end, I determined nevertheless to part with my life at as high a price as I could command. Strange as it may seem, my mind conceived of no intent on the part of my visitor save that of hostility. Accordingly, I became very quiet, in the hope that the unknown beast would, in the absence of a guiding sound, lose its direction as I had, and thus pass me by. But this hope was not destined for realization, for the strange footfall steadily advanced, the animal evidently having obtained my scent, which, in an atmosphere so absolutely free from all distracting influences as that of the cave, could doubtless be followed at great distance. Seeing, therefore, that I must be armed for defense against an uncanny and unseen attack in the dark, I grouped about me the largest of the fragments of the rock which were strewn upon all parts of the floor of the cavern in the vicinity, and, grasping one in each hand for immediate use, awaited with resignation the inevitable result. Meanwhile, the hideous pattering of the paws drew near. Certainly, the conduct of the creature was exceedingly strange. Most of the time, the tread seemed to be that of a quadruped, walking with a singular lack of unison betwixt hind and forefeet. Yet at brief and infrequent intervals, I fancied that but 2 feet were engaged in the process of locomotion. I wondered what species of animal was to confront me. It must, I thought, be some unfortunate beast who had paid for its curiosity to investigate one of the entrances of the fearful grotto with a lifelong confinement in its interminable recesses. It doubtless obtained as food the eyeless fish, bats, and rats of the cave, as well as some of the ordinary fish that are wafted in at every freshet of the Green River, which communicates in some occult manner with the waters of the cave. I occupied my terrible vigil with grotesque conjectures of what alterations cave life might have wrought in the physical structure of the beast, remembering the awful appearances ascribed by local tradition to the consumptives who had died after long residence in the cavern. Then I remembered with a start that, even should I succeed in killing my antagonist, I should never behold its form, as my torch had long since been extinct, and I was entirely unprovided with matches. The tension on my brain now became frightful. My disordered fancy conjured up hideous and fearsome shapes from the sinister darkness that surrounded me, and that actually seemed to press upon my body. Nearer, the dreadful footfalls approached. It seemed that I must give vent to a piercing scream, yet had I been sufficiently irresolute to attempt such a thing, my voice could scarce have responded. I was petrified, rooted to the spot. I doubted if my right arm would allow me to hurl its missile at the oncoming thing when the crucial moment should arrive. Now the steady pat-pat of the steps was close at hand. Now very close. I could hear the labored breathing of the animal, and terror-struck as I was, I realized that it must have come from a considerable distance, and was correspondingly fatigued. Suddenly the spell broke. My right hand, guided by my ever-trustworthy sense of hearing, threw with full force the sharp-angled bit of limestone which it contained toward that point in the darkness from which emanated the breathing and pattering. Wonderful to relate, it nearly reached its goal, for I heard the thing jump, landing at a distance away, where it seemed to pause. Having readjusted my arm, I discharged my second missile, this time most effectively, for with a flood of joy I listened as the creature fell in what sounded like a complete collapse, and evidently remained prone and unmoving. Almost overpowered by the great relief which rushed over me, I reeled back against the wall. The breathing continued in heavy, gasping inhalations and expirations, whence I realized that I had no more than wounded the creature. And now all desire to examine the thing ceased. At last something allied to groundless, superstitious fear had entered my brain, and I did not approach the body, nor did I continue to cast stones at it in order to complete the extinction of its life. Instead, I ran at full speed in what was, as nearly as I could estimate in my frenzied condition, the direction from which I had come. Suddenly I heard a sound, or rather a regular succession of sounds. In another instant they had resolved themselves into a series of sharp metallic clicks. This time there was no doubt. It was the guide. And then I shouted, yelled, screamed, even shrieked with joy as I beheld in the vaulted arches above the faint and glimmering effulgence which I knew to be the reflected light of an approaching torch. I ran to meet the flare, and before I could completely understand what had occurred, was lying upon the ground at the feet of the guide, embracing his boots, and gibbering, despite my boasted reserve, in a most meaningless and idiotic manner, pouring out my terrible story, and at the same time overwhelming my auditor with protestations of gratitude. At length I awoke to something like my normal consciousness. The guide had noted my absence upon the arrival of the party at the entrance of the cave, and had, from his own intuitive sense of direction, proceeded to make a thorough canvas of the nearby passages just ahead of where he had last spoken to me, locating my whereabouts after a quest of about 4 hours. By the time he had related this to me, I, emboldened by his torch and his company, began to reflect upon the strange beast which I had wounded but a short distance back in the darkness, and I suggested that we ascertain by the rushlight's aid what manner of creature was my victim. Accordingly, I retraced my steps, this time with a courage born of companionship, to the scene of my terrible experience. Soon we descried a white object upon the floor, an object whiter even than the gleaming limestone itself. Cautiously advancing, we gave vent to a simultaneous ejaculation of wonderment, for of all the unnatural monsters either of us had seen in our lifetime, this was in surpassing degree the strangest. It appeared to be an anthropoid ape of large proportions, escaped, perhaps, from some itinerant menagerie. Its hair was snow-white, a thing due, no doubt, to the bleaching action of a long existence within the inky confines of the cave. But it was also surprisingly thin, being indeed largely absent, save on the head, where it was of such length and abundance that it fell over the shoulders in considerable profusion. The face was turned away from us as the creature lay almost directly upon it. The inclination of the limbs was very singular, explaining, however, the alternation in their use which I had before noted, whereby the beast used sometimes all four, and on other occasions but two, for its progress. From the tips of the fingers or toes, long nail-like claws extended. The hands or feet were not prehensile, a fact that I ascribed to that long residence in the cave, which, as I before mentioned, seemed evident from the all-pervading and almost unearthly whiteness so characteristic of the whole anatomy. No tail seemed to be present. The respiration had now grown very feeble, and the guide had drawn his pistol with the evident intent of dispatching the creature, when a sudden sound emitted by the latter caused the weapon to fall unused. The sound was of a nature difficult to describe. It was not like the normal note of any known species of simian, and I wondered if this unnatural quality were not the result of a long-continued and complete silence, broken by the sensations produced by the advent of the light, a thing which the beast could not have seen since its first entrance into the cave. The sound, which I might feebly attempt to classify as a kind of deep-toned chattering, was faintly continued. All at once, a fleeting spasm of energy seemed to pass through the frame of the beast. The paws went through a convulsive motion, and the limbs contracted. With a jerk, the white body rolled over so that its face was turned in our direction. For a moment I was so struck with horror at the eyes thus revealed that I noted nothing else. They were black, those eyes, deep, jetty black, in hideous contrast to the snow-white hair and flesh. Like those of other cave denizens, they were deeply sunken in their orbits, and were entirely destitute of iris. As I looked more closely, I saw that they were set in a face less prognathous than that of an average ape, and infinitely more hairy. The nose was quite distinct. As I gazed upon the uncanny sight presented to our vision, the thick lips opened, and several sounds issued from them, after which the thing relaxed in death. The guide clutched my coat sleeve and trembled so violently that the light shook fitfully, casting weird moving shadows on the walls about us. I made no motion, but stood rigidly still, my horrified eyes fixed upon the floor ahead. Then fear left, and wonder, awe, compassion, and reverence succeeded in its place. For the sounds uttered by the stricken figure that lay stretched out on the limestone had told us the awesome truth. The creature I had killed, the strange beast of the unfathomed cave, was, or had at one time been, a man. And so concludes The Beast in the Cave by H.P. Lovecraft. Our next tale extraordinaire is from the pen of British author Walter de la Mare, titled Bad Company, in which a weary traveler encounters a stranger whose silent presence unsettles him more deeply than words can express. It reads as follows. It is very seldom that one encounters what would appear to be sheer, unadulterated evil in a human face. An evil, I mean, that's active, deliberate, deadly, and dangerous. Folly, heedlessness, vanity, pride, craft, meanness, stupidity, yes. But even Iagos in this world are few, and devilry is as rare as witchcraft. One winter's evening, some little time ago, bound on a visit to a friend in London, I found myself on the platform of one of its many subterranean railway stations. It is an ordeal that one may undergo as seldom as one can. The glare, the glitter, the noise, the very air one breathes affect nerves and spirits. One expects vaguely strange meetings in such surroundings. On this occasion, the expectation was justified. The mind is at times more attentive than the eye. Already tired and troubled with personal cares and problems, which a little wisdom and enterprise should have refused to entertain, I had seated myself on one of the low wooden benches to the left of the entrance to the platform, when, for no conscious reason, I was prompted to turn my head in the direction of a fellow traveler, seated across the gangway on the fellow to my bench some few yards away. What was wrong with him? He was enveloped in a loose cape or cloak, somber and motionless. He appeared to be wholly unaware of my abrupt scrutiny, and yet I doubt it. For the next moment, although the door of the nearest coach gaped immediately opposite him, he had shuffled into the compartment I had entered myself, and now, in its corner, confronted me, all but knee to knee. I could have touched him with my hand. We had, too, come at once into an even more intimate contact than that of touch. Our eyes, his own fixed in a dwelling and lethargic stare, and my own, which had uncharitably recoiled not only in misgiving, but in something little short of disgust. The effect resembled that of acid on milk, and for the time being cast my thoughts into confusion. Yet that one glance had taken him in. He was old. Over 70. A wide-brimmed, rusty, and dusty black hat concealed his head, a head fringed with wisps of hair, lank and paper-gray. His loose, jaded cheeks were of the color of putty, the thin lips above the wide, unshaven, and dimpled chin showing scarcely a trace of red. The cloak suspended from his shoulders mantled him to his shins. One knuckled, cadaverous, mittened hand clasped a thick ash stick, its black handle unpolished with long usage. The only sign of life in his countenance was secreted in his eyes, fixed on mine, hazed and dully glistening, as a snail in winter is fixed to a wall. There was a dull, deliberate challenge in them, and, as I fancied, something more than that. They suggested that he had been in wait for me, that for him it was almost well met. For minutes together I endeavored to accept their challenge, to make sure. Yet I realized, fascinated the while, that he was well aware of the futility of this attempt, as a snake is of the restless, fated bird in the branches above its head. Such a statement, I am aware, must appear wildly exaggerated, but I can only record my impression. It was already latish, much later than I had intended. The passengers came and went, and, whether intentionally or not, none consented to occupy the seat vacant beside him. I fixed my eyes on an advertisement immediately above his head, with the intention of watching him in the field of an eye that I could not persuade to meet his own in full focus again. he had instantly detected this ingenious device. By a fraction of an inch, he had lifted his grasp upon his stick. So intolerable at length became the physical and psychical effect of his presence on me that I determined to leave the train at the next station and there to await the next. And at this precise moment I was aware he had not only withdrawn his eyes, but closed them. I was not so easily to free myself of his company. A glance over my shoulder as, after leaving the train, I turned towards the lift, showed him hastily groping his way out of the carriage. The metal gate clanged. The lift slid upwards, and, such is the contrariness of human nature, a faint disappointment followed. One may, for example, be appalled and yet engrossed in reading an account of some act of infamous cruelty. Concealing myself as best I could at the bookstall, I awaited the next lift load. Its few passengers having dispersed, he himself followed. In spite of age and infirmity, he had, then, ascended alone the spiral staircase. Glancing, it appeared, neither to right nor left, he passed rapidly through the barrier. And yet, had he not seen me? The ticket collector raised his head, opened his mouth, watched his retreating figure, but made no attempt to retrieve his. It was dark now, the dark of London. In my absence underground, minute frozen pellets of snow had fallen, whitening the streets and lulling the sound of the traffic. On emerging into the street, he turned in the direction of the next station, my own. Yet again, he had, or had he not, been aware that he was being watched. However that might be, my journey lay his way, and that way my feet directed me, although I was already later than I had intended. I followed him, led on, no doubt, in part, merely by the effect he had on me. Some 20 or 30 yards ahead, his dark shapelessness showed, distinct against the whitening pavement. The waters of the Thames, I was aware, lay on my left. A muffled blast from the siren of a tug announced its presence. Keeping my distance, I followed him on. One lamppost, two, three. At that, he seemed to pause for a moment, as if to listen, momentarily glancing back, as I fancied, and vanished. When I came up with it, I found that this third lamppost vaguely illuminated the mouth of a narrow, lightless alleyway between highish walls. It led me, after a while, into another alley, yet dingier. The wall on the left of this was evidently that of a large garden. On the right came a row of nondescript houses, looming up in their neglect against the starless sky. The first of these houses appeared to be occupied. The next two were vacant. Dingy curtains, soot-gray against their snowy window-sills, hung over the next. A litter of paper and refuse, abandoned by the last long gust of wind that must have come whistling around the nearer angle of the house, lay under the broken flight of steps up to a mid-Victorian porch. The small snow clinging to the bricks and to the worn and weathered cement of the wall only added to its gaunt lifelessness. In the faint hope of other company coming my way, and vowing that I would follow no further than to the outlet of yet another pitch-black and uninviting alley or court, which might indeed prove a dead end, I turned into it. It was then that I observed, in the rays of the lamp over my head, that in spite of the fineness of the snow and the brief time that had elapsed, there seemed to be no trace on its surface of recent footsteps. A faintly thudding echo accompanied me on my way. I have found it very useful in the country always to carry a small electric torch in my greatcoat pocket. But for the time being, I refrained from using it. This alley proved not to be blind. Beyond a patch of waste ground, a nebulous leaden-gray vacancy marked a loop here of the Thames, and I decided to go no further. I then perceived a garden gate in the wall to my right. It was ajar, but could not have long been so, because no more than an instant's flash of my torch showed marks in the snow of its recent shifting. And yet there was little wind. On the other hand, here was the open river. Just a breath of a breeze across its surface might account for this. The cracked and blistered paint was shimmering with a thin coat of rime, a hoarfrost, and as if a finger had just now scrawled it there, a clumsy arrow showed its V, pointing inward. A tramp, an errand boy, or a mere accident might have accounted for this. It may indeed have been a mark made some time before on the paint. I paused in an absurd debate with myself, chiefly, I think, because I felt some little alarm at the thought of what might follow. I pushed the gate a little wide open, peered in, and made my way up a woody path beneath ragged, unpruned, and leafless fruit trees toward the house. The snow's own light revealed a ramshackle flight of steps up to a poor, Frenchified sort of canopy above French windows, one half of their glazed doors ajar. I ascended and peered into the intense gloom beyond it, and thus and then prepared to retrace my steps as quickly as possible, I called, in tones as near those of a London policeman as I could manage, "Hello there! Is anything wrong? Is anyone wanted?" After all, I could at least explain to my fellow passenger, if he appeared, that I found both his gate and his window open, and the house was hardly pleasantly situated. No answer was returned to me, though. In doubt and disquietude, but with a conviction that all was not well, I flashed my torch over the walls and furniture of the room and its heavily framed pictures. How could anything be well with unseen company such as this besieging one's senses? Ease and pleasant companionship the room may once have been capable of giving. In its dirt, cold, and neglect, it showed nothing of that now. I crossed it, paused again in the passage beyond it, and listened. I then entered the room beyond that. Venetian blinds, many of the slats of which had outworn their webbing, and heavy crimson chenille-sided curtains concealed its windows. The ashes of a fire showed beyond rusty bars of the grate under a black marble mantelpiece. An oil lamp on the table with a green shade exuded a stink of paraffin. Beyond was a table littered with books and papers, and an overturned chair. There I could see the bent-up old legs perceptibly lean beneath the trousers of the occupant of the room. In no doubt of whose remains these were, I drew near, and with bared teeth and icy trembling fingers, drew back the fold of the cloak that lay over the face. Death has a strange sorcery. A shuddering revulsion of feeling took possession of me. This cold, once-genteel, hideous, malignant room, and this. The skin of the blue loose cheek was drawn tight over the bone. The mouth lay a little open, showing the dislodged false teeth beneath. The dull, unspeculative eyes stared out from beneath lowered lids toward the black mouth of the chimney above the fireplace. Vileness and iniquity had left their marks on the lifeless features, and yet it was rather with compassion than with horror and disgust that I stood regarding them. What desolate solitude, what misery must this old man, abandoned to himself, have experienced during the last years of his life, encountering nothing but enmity and the apprehension of his fellow creatures? I am not intending to excuse or even commiserate what I cannot understand, but the almost complete absence of any goodness in the human spirit cannot but condemn the heart to an appalling isolation. Had he been murdered, or had he come to a violent but natural end? In either case, horror and terror must have supervened. That I had been enticed and deliberately led on to this discovery, I hadn't the least doubt, extravagant though this too may seem. Why? What for? I could not bring myself to attempt to light the lamp. Besides, in that last vigil, it must have burnt itself out. My torch revealed a stub of candle on the mantelpiece. I lit it. He seemed to have been engaged in writing when the enemy of us all had approached him in silence and had struck him down. A long and unsealed envelope lay on the table. I drew out the contents, a letter and a will, which had been witnessed some few weeks before, apparently by a tradesman's boy and possibly by some derelict charwoman, Eliza Hanks. I knew enough about such things to be sure that the will was valid and complete. This old man had been evidently more than fairly rich in this world's goods and reluctant to surrender them. The letter was addressed to his two sisters, Amelia and Maud. Standing there in the cold and the silence and utterly alone, I read the vilest letter that had ever come my way, even in print. It started that he knew the circumstances of these two remaining relatives, that he was well aware of their poverty and physical conditions. One of them, it seemed, was afflicted with cancer. He proceeded to explain that, although they should, by the intention of their mother, have had the due share of her property and the money she had left, it rejoiced him to think that his withholding of this knowledge must continually have added to their wretchedness. Why he so hated them was only vaguely suggested. The will he had enclosed with the letter left all he possessed to, of all human establishments that needed it the least, the authorities of Scotland Yard. It was to be devoted, it ran, to the detection of such evildoers as are ignorant or imbecile enough to leave their misdemeanors and crimes detectable. It is said that confession is good for the soul. Well, then, as publicly as possible, I take this opportunity of announcing that, there and then, I made a little heap of envelope, letter, and will on the hearth, and put a match to them. When every vestige of the paper had been consumed, I stamped the ashes down. I had touched nothing else. I would leave the vile, jaded, forsaken house to reveal its own secret, and I might ensure that that would not be long delayed. What continues to perplex me is that, so far as I can see, no other agency but that of this evil old recluse himself had led me to my discovery. Why? Can it have been with this very intention? I stooped down and peeped and peered narrowly in under the lowered lids in the light of my torch, but not the feeblest flicker, remotest signal, or faintest syllabling echo of any message rewarded me. Dead fish are less unseemly. And yet, well, we are, all of us, I suppose, at any extreme, capable of remorse and not utterly shut against repentance. Is it possible that this priceless blessing is not denied us, even when all that's earthly else appear to have come to an end? And so concludes Bad Company by Walter de la Mare. We continue now with a curious story from the pen of famed American author of The Strange and the Macabre, Ambrose Bierce, and it's titled Staley Fleming's Hallucination. Now, in his introduction to this story, found in the anthology Ghosts, A Treasury of Chilling Tales, Old and New, editor Marvin Kaye writes, "Spectral hounds occur more than once in a genre of fiction. The original version of Faulkner's The Hound concerned a departed canine who sought revenge for its own and its master's murders. Masefield's vicious pack harrows mortals elsewhere in this volume, and you don't have to be a Doyle buff to be acquainted with the Hound of the Baskervilles. Here is another nasty mutt, courtesy of Ambrose Bierce, who grew from a poverty-stricken Connecticut childhood to become one of America's best-known essayists and prosodists. The essence of Bierce is savagely withering satire. He was so disenchanted with his fellows that it is little wonder he disappeared in Mexico and was never again heard from. He was born in 1842, but it is unlikely that anyone will ever know when he left this plane, probably with a disgusted sneer on his lip. And so, without further ado, here's Staley Fleming's Hallucination by Ambrose Bierce. Of two men who were talking, one was a physician. "I sent you, doctor," said the other, "but I don't think you can do me any good. Maybe you can recommend a specialist of psychopathy, I fancy I'm a bit loony. Well, you look all right to me, the physician said. You shall judge. I have hallucinations. I wake every night and see in my room, intently watching me, a big black Newfoundland dog with a white forefoot. Ah, you say you were awake. Are you sure about that? Hallucinations are sometimes only dreams, you know. Oh, I'm awake, all right. Sometimes I lie still a long time, looking at the dog as earnestly as the dog looks at me, and I always leave the light going. When I can't endure it any longer, I sit up in bed, and nothing's there. And what's the beast's expression? Asked the doctor. Well, it seems sinister to me. Of course, I know that, except in art, an animal's face in repose has always the same expression. But this is not a real animal. Newfoundland dogs are pretty mild-looking, you know. What's the matter with this one? Well, really, my diagnosis would have no value. I'm not going to treat the dog. The physician laughed at his own pleasantry, but narrowly watched his patient from the corner of his eye. Presently he said, Fleming, your description of beasts fits the dog of the late Artwell Barton. Fleming half rose from his chair, sat again, and made a visible attempt at indifference. I remember Barton, he said. I believe he was, it was reported that, wasn't there something suspicious in his death? Looking squarely now into the eyes of his patient, the physician said, 3 years ago, the body of your old enemy, Artwell Barton, was found in the woods near his home and yours. He had been stabbed to death. There have been no arrests. There was no clue. Some of us had theories. I had one. Have you? I? Why, bless your soul, what could I know about it? You remember that I left for Europe almost immediately afterward, a considerable time afterward. In the few weeks since my return, you could not expect me to construct a theory. In fact, I've not given the matter a thought. What about his dog? It was first to find the body, replied the physician. It died of starvation on his grave. We do not know the inexorable law underlying coincidences. Daly Fleming did not, or he would perhaps not, have sprung to his feet as the night wind brought in through the open window the long wailing howl of a distant dog. He strode several times across the room in the steadfast gaze of the physician. Then, abruptly confronting him, almost shouted, "What has all this to do with my trouble, Dr. Haldeman? You forget why you were sent for." Rising, the physician laid his hand upon his patient's arm and said gently, "Pardon me, I cannot diagnose your disorder off of hand. Tomorrow, perhaps. Please go to bed now and leave your door unlocked. I will pass the night here with your books. Can you call me without rising?" "Yes, there's an electric bell." "Good. If anything disturbs you, push the button without sitting up. Good night." Comfortably installed in an armchair, the man of medicine stared into the glowing coals and thought deeply and long, but apparently to little purpose, for he frequently rose and, opening a door leading to the staircase, listened intently. Then he resumed his seat. Presently, however, he fell asleep, and when he woke, it was past midnight. He stirred the failing fire, lifted a book from the table at his side, and looked at the title. It was Denecker's Meditations. He opened it at random and began to read, "Forasmuch as it is ordained of God that all flesh hath spirit, and thereby taketh on spiritual powers, so also the spirit hath powers of the flesh, even when it is gone out of the flesh and liveth as a thing apart, as many a violence performed by Wraith and Lemure showeth. And there be those who say that man is not single in this, but that the beasts have the like evil inducement, and—" The reading was interrupted by a shaking of the house, as by the fall of a heavy object. The reader flung down the book, rushed from the room, and mounted the stairs to Fleming's bedchamber. He tried the door, but contrary to his instructions, it was locked. He set his shoulder against it with such force that it finally gave way. On the floor, near the disordered bed, in his nightclothes, lay Fleming, gasping away his life. The physician raised the dying man's head from the floor and observed a wound in the throat. "I should have thought of this," he said, believing it suicide. When the man was dead, an examination disclosed the unmistakable marks of an animal's fangs, deeply sunken in the jugular vein. But there was no animal. So ends Staley Fleming's Hallucination by Ambrose Bierce. You know, mirrors and cameras traditionally have been objects of distrust in many folk traditions, probably because they are believed to have the power to entrap a person's soul. The following tale, The Dead Woman's Photograph, by an author unknown, happens to offer a variation of that theme. Be advised that this work is a product of its time and place and may include values, images, and language that may be offensive to modern sensibilities. Here, then, is The Dead Woman's Photograph, by Anonymous. Virgil Hoyt is a photographer's assistant up at St. Paul, and a man of a good deal of taste. He has been in search of the picturesque all over the West and hundreds of miles to the north in Canada, and can speak three or four Indian dialects and put a canoe through the rapids. That is to say, he is a man of an adventurous sort, and is no dreamer. He can fight well, and shoot well, and swim well enough to put up a winning race with the Indian boys, and he can sit all day in the saddle and not dream about it at night. Wherever he goes, he uses his camera. The world, Hoyt is in the habit of saying to those who sit with him as he smokes his pipe, was created in 6 days to be photographed. Man, and especially woman, was made for the same purpose. Clouds are not made to give moisture, nor trees to cast shade. They were created, rather, for the photographer. In short, Virgil Hoyt's view of the world is whimsical, and he doesn't like to be bothered with anything disagreeable. That is the reason that he loathes and detests going to a house of mourning to photograph a corpse. The horribly bad taste of it offends him partly, and partly he is annoyed at having to shoulder, even for a few moments, a part of someone's burden of sorrow. He doesn't like sorrow, and would willingly canoe 500 miles up the cold Canadian rivers to get rid of it. Nevertheless, as assistant photographer, it is often his duty to do this very kind of thing. Not long ago, he was sent for by a rich Jewish family at St. Paul to photograph the mother, who had just died. He was very much put out, but he went. He was taken to the front parlor, where the dead woman lay in her coffin. It was evident that there was some excitement in the household, and that a discussion was going on, but Hoyt wasn't concerned, and so he paid no attention to the matter. The daughter wanted the coffin turned on end, in order that the corpse might face the camera properly, but Hoyt said he could overcome the recumbent attitude and make it appear that the face was taken in the position it would naturally hold in life, and so they went out and left him alone with the dead. The face was a strong and positive one, such as may often be seen among Jewish matrons. Hoyt regarded it with some admiration, thinking to himself that she was a woman who had been used to having her own way. There was a strand of hair out of place, and he pushed it back from her brow. A bud lifted its head too high from among the roses on her breast and spoiled the contour of the chin, so he broke it off. He remembered these things later very distinctly, and that his hand touched her bare face 2 or 3 times. Then he took the photographs and left the house. He was very busy at the time, and several days elapsed before he was able to develop the plates. He took them from the bath, in which they had lain with a number of others, and went to work upon them. There were 3 plates, he having taken that number merely as a precaution against any accident. They came up well, but as they developed, he became aware of the existence of something in the photographs which had not been apparent to his eye. The mysterious always came under the head of the disagreeable with him, and was therefore to be banished. So he made only a few prints, and put the things away out of sight. He hoped that something would intervene to save him from attempting an explanation. But it is a part of the general perplexity of life that things do not intervene as they ought and when they ought. So one day his employer asked him what had become of those photographs. He tried to evade him, but it was futile, and he got out the finished photographs and showed them to him. The older man sat, staring at them a long time. "Hoyt," he said at last, "you're a young man, and I suppose you have never seen anything like this before. But I have. Well, not exactly the same thing, but similar phenomena have come my way a number of times since I went into the business, and I want to tell you there are things in heaven and earth not dreamt of." "Oh, I know all that tommyrot," cried Hoyt angrily. "But when anything happens, I want to know the reason why, and how it is done." "All right," said his employer, "then you might explain why and how the sun rises." But he humored the younger man sufficiently to examine with him the bath in which the plates were submerged, and the plates themselves. All was as it should be. But the mystery was there, and could not be done away with. Hoyt hoped against hope that the friends of the dead woman would somehow forget about the photographs. But, of course, the wish was unreasonable, and one day the daughter appeared and asked to see the photographs of her mother. "Well, to tell you the truth," stammered Hoyt, "those didn't come out as well as we should wish." "But let me see them," persisted the lady. "I'd like to look at them anyway." "Well, now," said Hoyt, trying to be soothing, as he believed it was always best to be with women. To tell the truth, he was an ignoramus where women were concerned. "I think it would be better if you didn't see them. There are reasons why—" He stumbled on like this, stupid man that he was. "And, of course, the Jewess said she would see those pictures without any further delay." So poor Hoyt brought them out and placed them in her hand, and then ran for the water pitcher, and had to be at the bother of bathing her forehead to keep her from fainting. For what the lady had saw was this. Over face and flowers and the head of the coffin fell a thick veil, the edges of which touched the floor in some places. It covered the features so well that not a hint of them was visible. "There was nothing over mother's face," cried the lady at length. "Not a thing," acquiesced Hoyt. "I know, because I had the occasion to touch her face just before I took the picture. I put some of her hair back from her brow." "What does it mean, then?" asked the lady. "Well, you know better than I. There is no explanation in science. Perhaps there is some in psychology." "Well," said the lady, stammering a little and coloring, "mother was a good woman, but she always wanted her own way, and she always had it, too." "Yes, and she never would have her picture taken. She didn't admire herself. She said no one should ever see a picture of hers." "Is that so?" said Hoyt meditatively. "Well, she's kept her word, hasn't she?" The two stood looking at the pictures for a time. Then Hoyt pointed to the open blaze in the grate. "Throw them in," he commanded. "Don't let your father see them, and don't keep them yourself. They wouldn't be good things to keep." "That's true enough," said the lady slowly, and she threw them in the fire. Then Virgil Hoyt brought out the plates and broke them before her eyes. And that was the end of it, except that Hoyt sometimes tells the story to those who sit beside him when his pipe is lit. Thus concludes The Dead Woman's Photograph by Anonymous. We now conclude today's program with a bit of flash fiction from the pen of Virginia Young, titled, You Can't Find Me. It reads as follows. She stood at a makeshift easel and slashed shades and shapes of blue shard-like streaks and knife-blade gray paint across the oblong scrap of masonite. With the surface completely covered, the finished piece closely resembled a turbulent, storm-filled evening sky. She breathed deeply, left the brush to soak in an old jelly jar half-filled with tepid water, and felt her hands, her arms, her entire body relax. Consumed, she sat down on the floor of the attic and scanned the painting as if she had just given birth. She liked it. She wasn't sure why, but the hues were blending, greeting one another easily, and for whatever reason, the exertion from creating it had set her free, temporarily. She lay back until she could feel her spine and shoulder blades against the hardwood floor, and she stared at the dark, slatted ceiling. With her right arm bent to cover her eyes against the pure north light insisting itself through two ample windows, she closed her eyelids and felt drained, as if she had participated in and won an intense physical fight. After 10 or 12 minutes, she sat up straight and stared again at the blue painting. It was, she knew, a reflection of her misery exposed. Her eyes moved to the windows, where deepening gray and fast-moving clouds assembled, and she could tell by the light that it was getting late. She needed to move from this space. She stood, collected the jar of water, and called to the cat. They needed to be downstairs. He'd soon be home. Hope you enjoyed listening to today's stories as much as I've enjoyed reading them to you. And I'm here to remind you that you've been listening to Extraordinary Tales, a production of Audio Journal, proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you have any comments or suggestions for Extraordinary Tales, please let us know by calling us at 508-797-1117. Or by emailing us at info@audiojournal.org, or by mailing us directly at Audio Journal, 799 West Boylston Street, Worcester, Massachusetts, 01606. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or you can go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm George Bloomquist, thanking you for listening. And now, stay tuned for other local programming brought to you by Audio Journal. Audio Journal is supported in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. We are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
What's your vision?
My vision's 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye and zero vision in the left eye.
20/200 at best on my left eye, and on my right eye I cannot see.
No, I mean, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
My vision is employment opportunities for all, including people with disabilities.
My vision is for all of my students to dream big.
That he become fully independent.
For my patients to live their best lives.
What's your vision?
What's your vision?
What is your vision?
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, our vision is clear. We believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.